thanks very much. Thanks. Does this thing work?
Yeah.
Hopefully. Okay. Thanks very much. Thank you for the invitation. This is a little bit of an unusual endeavor for me. I got involved in this project kind of accidentally. I was visiting IPAM, the Institute of Pure and Applied Math in California, for a few months, and I met my collaborator, Dr. Kerry Salafia from New York. And the project has developed quite successfully, but still, I'm a mathematician, so my background in medicine is whatever I learned from Kerry, from my co-author, so just forgive me if I say something which sounds stupid to some of you. Okay, so, and another, okay, so first let me, oh, wait, I know, there, I'm not doing this right. There should be a way to freeze this. Okay, so why is it first of all important or interesting to study the placenta? It's becoming a part of an accepted wisdom that our development before birth has serious health implications for us throughout our adult life. Various fairly simple things have been measured and confirmed, that, for example, your birth weight has implications to the likelihood that you would develop heart disease. And while such things are well known and statistically well confirmed, the mechanisms are usually not well understood. So the idea is then that it is important and interesting to try to diagnose future health risks when a baby is born. And now here, it's at this point where placentas come into play, because on the one hand, placentas are really important for the development of the fetus. All the nutrients, nutrient exchange, oxygen, food, the removal of waste, everything goes through the placenta. And then once the baby is born, well, that's one organ it can do without. So you can study it to your heart's content, and the goal is then, so it could be a really convenient diagnostic tool if we can understand it, that on the one hand should record everything that happens to the fetus, and on the other hand it's completely unnecessary to the baby once the baby is born. Okay. Now, okay, you have to appreciate the fact that I'm showing you a black and white picture of a placenta, since the first talks I've seen on this by Kerry featured a bunch of these pictures in vivid color, and they're rather difficult to stomach for a mathematician. Okay, so here is a typical placenta. It's typically round in shape. You can see in the middle the insertion point of the umbilical cord. So this is where the umbilical cord was inserted. And it's, normally developed placenta would look like a pancake, basically. Uniformly thick, reasonably round, umbilical cord inserted in the center when it comes out. Now, on the inside, this is, oops, making the same mistake again. Okay, on the inside, It's little more than one large vascular tree, which grows from the insertion point of the umbilical cord. So if you do an angiogram of this, an x-ray of a placenta injected with radioactive dye to highlight the vasculature, you see that this is really one large vascular tree, which grows from the point where the umbilical cord is inserted. Okay, now, as you can imagine, such a tree is would be rather difficult to analyze. So just saying something about the structure of this tree, saying whether it has developed normally or not, is not, in general, an easy task. So the simplest thing we could try to determine is whether the placenta has a normally developed shape. This simple-minded approach. Now, about 75% of all placentas that you would get would look round with the umbilical cord roughly in the middle and would have uniform thickness, so they would have what empirically you would think of as a normal shape. And in fact, we have calculated, so Alex Schlachter is actually present here, he's my collaborator from Toronto on these questions. We have actually calculated, and it's really not surprising, that this is indeed the mean placental shape, a disc with the umbilical cord inserted in the middle. However, deviations from this normal shape are fairly common. So like I said, about 75% of all of them would look roughly like this, but about 25% won't. And the ones which don't look sometimes surprisingly regular. So about 5% of them look like stars. Okay, they really do look like stars. So this is a typical star-like one. Another 5% would have several large lobes, typically between 2 and 4. 3 seems to be the most typical number. So this would be a typical placenta with several large lobes. Don't pay any attention to this. This is just a tear when it came out. It really had 3 well-defined roundish lobes. And that one really does look like a star. And I could show you a lot of pictures like this. So and basically this is what got me started on this project, that somehow these irregular shapes look suspiciously regular. And you know, the wisdom, kind of the commonly accepted wisdom, would be that the placenta would not be round because there would be some obstacle to its growth. Either there would be some obstacle in the uterus, or perhaps part of the placenta would die, and then the rest would sort of grow around that place. So in particular, this would be explained by having an obstacle here, an obstacle here, an obstacle here, an obstacle up there, an obstacle up there, and the placenta would grow in between them. Okay. So I'm going to try to convince you that this is not perhaps the right explanation. Let me try to give you actually an idea of what I'm going to talk about next. So here is a really rough idea. So suppose I wanted to explain how these shapes appear. Okay, so here's an idea. Okay, on the inside, the placenta is just one large vascular tree, right, which grows from the uterus. So you from the umbilical insertion point. So you can imagine, so here's where the umbilical cord is inserted, and you can imagine that you have this tree growing. First, the large branches develop, you know, eventually they'll grow to a certain size. Then mid-sized branches grow off of these. and then smaller branches, and so on. And in the end, you fill out what roughly looks like a disk. Okay? Now imagine the following scenario. Imagine that something happens early in the life of the placenta which suppresses the vascular growth. Okay? How would the resulting tree look? I mean, it's just a tree which is supposed to grow to fill out this round shape. Well, the large branches start to grow early, so they would still grow normally, but the mid-sized branches would be affected. They won't grow as large as they're supposed to. And then, once you attach the small branches to them, they won't have enough reach to fill out the disk. So the shape you end up would be something like this.
So where's the obstacle? The obstacle?
Oh, there is no obstacle. That's a silly explanation. We're not going to... There is no obstacle. Would you really believe that there is... That there would be five symmetric obstacles, in 5% of the cases. I mean, these things are really, this is not, I could show you 20 of these. I mean, they really look remarkably symmetric. Okay, now imagine that this same scenario happens later in the development of the placenta. So you have this tree. The large branches develop normally, so do the mid-sized branches. But now what's affected are the branches of the next level. So they won't fill out the gaps between the mid-sized branches. And then what you would have would look somehow like this. Okay? And would be something star-like. Okay, so that's a very rough idea of an explanation. So the idea is then that the reason that these shapes appear and that the shape of the placenta deviates from normal is that at some point in its development there is a deviation in the development of the vascular tree. Okay, and that would affect the shape. Okay, then how would we test something like this? So we need then a dynamical model of growth for the placental vascular tree. Okay, so well, let me scroll back and show you the vascular tree again. So this is what a placental vascular tree looks like when it's fully grown. Now it grows by a process which is called angiogenesis, which can be described as growth at the tips. So the tips of this tree would sprout some new growth. The biological mechanism of this is fairly well understood, and it's important in various settings. For example, it's important in the development of cancer drugs, since angiogenesis is important for the growth of tumors at certain sites. Okay, so locally, this mechanism is fairly well understood. There are quite nice local models for the growth of this tree. If I point you to a tip where the growth would occur, it's fairly, there are fairly good ways to describe how it would grow. But that's not what we are after. We are after describing a global model of angiogenesis. I want to grow the whole tree. And now here's a mathematical question. You're given a tree, how do you find its tips? Okay, how do you identify the points where it would grow next, in the next moment of time? It's a fairly trivial question if the tree has very few branches. Okay, just randomly pick one of them, and that's where it will grow next. But this one has a lot of branches. It doesn't have few branches. So how do you find them? So there is a way to do that. Okay. Let me scroll down, save this. Okay, so how do we identify tips of a tree? So there is a way to do this, which is the following. Imagine you have a tree, like a garden variety tree. So you have a tree growing somewhere. And suppose you want to find its tips. What you should do is you should release a cloud of flies away from this tree, blind flies, okay? So they won't fly with any sense of direction. They would sort of randomly move in space. Some of them might hit the tree, okay? So they would land on the tree somewhere. So the places where they land are the tips. Okay. That is known as the theorem of Kakutani. So if you release a cloud of diffusion particle, in two dimensions all of them will land. In three dimensions you have to condition by the landing. But anyhow, the tips are where they land. And if you want to find the probability of the new growth, in the most simplistic model, that's exactly what you should do. So here is a little picture. This is a two-dimensional tree with 8 branches, and 100 flies was released, and 2D, all of them land, okay? 100 diffusion particles. And you can see where they land on this tree. Okay. There is a model of growth in physics, which is known as diffusion limited aggregation, DLA, which is based on this principle. It was introduced by Witten and Sander in the year 1981. And the idea is exactly this. At the moment of time n, you have a cluster consisting of n units of growth. Actually, I'm making the same mistake. Let me save this. And you release a blind fly, a random walker, a particle which moves without any sense of direction, and mark the first moment when it makes contact with your cluster. This is where the new growth will occur. Then you augment this cluster with a new unit of growth in whichever way you like. I mean, if you have some local model of growth, you follow that, or if not, you could just, you know, just literally augment it by attaching a unit of growth in the place where this diffusion particle has landed. This has a nice interpretation from electrostatics, which I'll probably, well, seeing enough mathematicians in the audience, I can mention this. Probability of new growth in this way is the same as the harmonic measure of the tree. If you take this tree, make it out of a conductor, and put a unit charge in it, so then all the charge will be on the surface. And as you know from electrostatics, it will concentrate at the tips of the tree. And so the harmonic measure of some part of the tree is simply the charge which sits there. Okay, so in this case, all the charge is going to be at the tips. And you find this charge by randomly walking towards the tree and looking where you land. And that is actually the statement of Kakutani's theorem. So here is a movie made by Alex of our model. This is what a model of angiogenesis, of placental angiogenesis, looks like in action based on this principle. On the left, you have the XY view, and on the right, you have YZ view. The growth is in a hemisphere, which imitates the wall of the uterus. And you can see that this growth, well, it's not done yet, but it's fairly close to being done. It's remarkably round, right, of uniform thickness. It's sort of what you would expect to happen. So this is our model. Okay, this is the model of angiogenesis in of placental vasculature. Somehow, strangely enough, I would have thought that this would be well known in the literature, but it seems that no one has ever thought of this before us. Not just for placentas, for angiogenesis in general. Okay, so anyhow, so now we have a model which which models the growth of the placental vascular tree, so we can check our hypothesis. There is a natural parameter in this model which changes the branching structure. There is a way to suppress the growth of the vasculature at different moments of time. And the results that we would get depends on when this growth was suppressed. The parameter is very simple. When your blind fly hits the tree, in the original model it lands. In the modified version, there is another parameter, which is the probability, a number between 0 and 1, which is the probability that it lands. So the fly might not land the first time it hits the tree. If that happens, then it continues to fly along the tree. It will land soon, right? It's already nearly in contact with the tree, but not at the very tip. Okay, so the diffusion would spread along the branches. So the effect of this is to suppress the growth of the branches, or if you like, make fuzzier tips. The mathematical aspect of this is that instead of taking the harmonic density, you take the positive power of the harmonic density, and you use that as a parameter. So what happens if you do that? If the change happens at 5% of overall growth, so very early in the game, this is what you get. The large branches grow normally, and after that all the growth is suppressed, so they don't fill the spatial shape of a disk, and what you get is several large lobes, as we had expected. So here on the left is a model, on the right is an actual placenta. And if you change later in the game, so at about 50% of overall growth, when the mid-sized branches have already grown, you get a star. So this is a typical star. You can see that the sort of the skeleton, the large and mid-sized branches are there. But there are these black gaps between them, where the branches of smaller size have not penetrated because the growth there is suppressed. Okay. All right, so this is our explanation of the mechanism. It's valuable because it also relates the shape, well, it relates the shape with two things. First of all, it relates the shape to the stresses to the development of the vasculature, but it also helps identify the timing of the stress, which is important. So, for example, earlier stresses hurt more than later ones in general. Okay, now, how would one, all right, so this is, I don't know if this explanation convinces you, but it looked pretty convincing to us. But then the question is, how does one check such a thing? How do we verify this? Of course, we could take actual placentas and try to analyze the structure of the vascular tree and compare with the model. And this can be done to some extent. So Carrie has a trained, well-trained assistant who can actually trace the blood vessels by hand to a certain level. And here is an example. So on the left you have a normally developed placenta, and on the right is a trilobe, and you can see visually, or you can get some numerical, quantitative measures that the density of mid-sized branches is more on the left than on the right. So mid-sized branches are missing on the right, and this is sort of the mechanism which we would expect. But this has several drawbacks. No, first of all, of course, it's qualitative. This is done by hand, so as opposed to a mathematical model, which you can analyze to death on a computer, this is not very reliable, even if a very well-qualified person does it. Second, it costs about $50 a pop. Okay? So this is not something you would want to routinely do in a lab. Depends on your funding, of course, but still. Okay, so now I'm going... So we have a different way of testing this, and I'm going to tell you about it, and this will look like a completely unrelated story to a point, and then the two storylines will merge. Okay, so here is another storyline. So let us keep this for a second. So the underlying idea is to figure out how does the change in branching affect the effectiveness of the placenta. And what is the placenta supposed to do effectively? Well, it's supposed to provide nourishment to the fetus. So the question is, how well does it work as a metabolic transport network? So for example, if we have a baby and a placenta delivered at the same time, can they tell if the baby has grown, has been fed reasonably well by this placenta? So the most basic question you can ask is whether it's just, how does the mass of the baby compare to the mass of the placenta? Like if a placenta is huge, for example, baby should be bigger. Has it grown proportionally bigger in whatever sense of proportion? So how do the masses compare? Okay, so in a sequence of other papers, we investigated this question with the assumption that there is a scaling law, that the placental mass is the fetal mass to some power. Now, this is a version of something which is known in biology as Kleiber's law. So there is a law, an empirical law. Kleiber is the person who formulated it in the 1930s, which says that the metabolic rate of an organism is proportional to its body mass to the power of 3/4. Okay? In the line above, we're using the placental mass as a proxy for the metabolic rate. And body mass is the mass of the fetus. Okay, there's something really amusing about Kleiber's law. So Kleiber formulated this in a paper in 1932 by basically really carefully analyzing whatever data was available for whatever species the metabolic rate has been measured in relation to the body mass. And then he spent basically the rest of his life fighting the critics of this law. And the reason he had to do this, so I have a copy of his book, probably the last edition, which came out in 1975, so this was either immediately before or immediately after his death. And like 2/3 of the book is an attack on the critics of this law. And the reason that this needs defending is because it's so obviously false. Now, why is it false? Well, let's ask ourselves, how should the body mass scale in relation to the metabolic rate? Okay, the metabolic rate is a heat exchange, right? So the rate of metabolism should be proportional to the surface area. Right? The surface area scales like the square of the linear size. The body mass scales as a cube. So the exponent should be 2/3 rather than 3/4. However, Kleiber was Swiss. He didn't make any assumptions. He measured the available data really carefully. And you can't help it at 3/4. Now, it's important. Oh, yeah, I should really do this. Yeah, it's important to point out that the metabolic rate, basal, means at rest. So the metabolic rate is both difficult to define and difficult to measure. So first of all, it's difficult. Well, the definition is difficult because what constitutes metabolic exchange in an organism is not so terribly straightforward. Secondly, it's pretty difficult to measure. Imagine taking an adult horse, putting it inside a thermostat, measuring both the intake and, pardon me, the output, and and literally, I mean, this is not an easy thing to do. And this is the chart from his book, and you can see that the number of measurement is 26. Okay, so this is it's really pretty hard to both define and measure. However, when you see how this scales, okay, this is a chart from a fairly recent paper. Disregard the stuff which tells about scaling and mitochondria. I don't know what to make of it. Look at the blue line with the blue dots. Okay, you can see that the fit to the 3/4 is pretty good. And you also see that there is not too many dots even in the year 2002. So maybe 26 has been replaced by, I don't know, 50. Okay. So why is it 3/4 and not 2/3, by the way? Kleiber almost made the correct argument in his book, but he couldn't quite do it because the word fractal wasn't yet present in the literature. See, the area which we would like to talk about is not the outer surface area. Okay? On the inside, we're talking about these transport networks, about trees with rather fractal structure. Okay? They don't scale in the same way as the surface area. Okay. So, if you can look at really simplistic examples, like if you make an organism which is shaped as a fractal. So here is an example. Von Koch snowflake. Okay. It's a two-dimensional problem, so the exponent should be 1/2, right? 0.5. So it's a two-dimensional problem, except now this, the boundary is not shaped as a disk, it's shaped as a fractal, Von Koch snowflake, and we cut it off at some size L0. This is the smallest biological size, biological scale of our organism. Then the area, it's a nice exercise for an undergraduate to figure out that the area is going to scale as the perimeter is going to scale as the area to something like 0.63, log 2 over log 3. Okay, that's more than a half. So you're going to get a larger scale and exponent. I should mention that there exist at least some attempts in the literature. Most notable of them is West, Brown, and Enquist, who give a fairly convincing explanation for plants, but an explanation which does not convince me at all for pulsatory networks like our, you know, own vasculature, of where 3/4 comes from, and they're also based on the fact that the circulatory network is a fractal, okay, rather than a ball. So, like I said, for plants, what they say seems to make sense, but for pulsatory networks, I would say it's wide open. I actually think this is a really nice mathematical question to come up with a convincing model for 3/4. Okay. I have some speculation of what such a thing should be like. Anyhow, we're not going to worry about that. It's not the goal anyhow. We have a scale and exponent, which relates the placental mass or the fetal mass. The scale and exponent should be some form of fractal dimension of the vasculature. Even if we don't know exactly what it is, how to measure this fractal dimension, we know that it's there. So if we calculate this exponent and for the pair fetus and placenta, we could see how effective the placenta is as a transport network. So that's the next idea. Okay, let's see how this works out. So actually, in 1966, Ahern proposed that the right exponent beta should be 2/3 for the reasons which are already familiar to us, and nobody checked this ever since. So fortunately, both the fetal mass and the placental mass are easy to measure, and there are large data sets in which you can find both. Fetal, of course, birth weight is always recorded carefully, and placental weight is recorded in many studies. And in particular, there is a study called the Collaborative Perinatal Project, in which there are something like 26,000 pairs of birth weight and the placental weight recorded in one large data set. So that's perfectly well suited for a statistical study, and this is what we got. Beta is 0.78, slightly higher than 0.75, plus minus 0.02. So first of all, so a couple things are interesting here. Oh, by the way, keep in mind that it's slightly higher, okay? This is going to be important, but for the moment, let's not worry about it. It's close enough to 0.75. So nobody, of course, claims that it's exactly 3/4, right? Pi over 4 would also work and would not be distinguishable in experiments. So, okay, so first of all, we're not talking about 26 tests. We're talking about 26,000 tests. So this is a pretty good confirmation of the Kleiber's law, just on theoretical grounds. Secondly, it tells you that the metric system is really important, because the coefficient here, alpha, turns out to be 1 for all practical purposes, and that's just a miracle of grams. If you go to ounces, beta doesn't change, but alpha does. Beta is not going to change from the change of units, but alpha will, and for ounces you'd get something ugly, 2.6 something. And for grams, you get 1. Okay, so beta is just a ratio of 2 logs. It's really easy to measure. Okay. No, you wouldn't miss it. It would just be harder to compute, because you would have an unpleasant coefficient to subtract or divide by. Of course, yeah. I mean, nothing would, I mean, the linear regression wouldn't care if your line is, you know, vertically translated. That wouldn't make any difference. Yeah. Still, grams are really important. Okay, so, and this is what we were aiming for, right? We ran the statistics on a data set of about 1,300 placentas for which we have the shape recorded. And sure enough, the deviation from 3/4, so just the delta beta, is very strongly correlated with the variation in shape. And how is it correlated? Deformed placentas are less effective. You need larger betas if your placenta is a star. So, and that's why this number is a little higher. Okay, we cannot prove it here. In this data set, the shapes are not recorded. At least not, some parameters are recorded, but not well enough for us to do this. Okay? In a smaller data set, we can give very precise correlations with various measurements of the shape. But this indicates that the true scaling is really close to 0.75, and that 0.75 is a good indicator of the normal development of the vasculature. Okay? So the placentas which are deformed, tend to produce smaller babies for the corresponding placental weight. And now, how is this useful as a diagnostic tool? Well, we could do some tests.
Did you find lower babies?
I'm sorry?
Did you find lower babies?
There's some, I mean, certainly, this is not, I mean, there's some spread, right?
As many as higher babies?
No. No.
So the main deviation was
up. Well, you could see that, right? The if we can, yeah, so in a smaller data set, yes, I understand the question, yes. In the smaller data set where we can actually record the shape and we can correct for the shape or we can remove the deformed ones, you get very close to 0.75. So, there are various things which are known to affect the development of the fetal and placental vasculature. Pre-existing maternal diabetes, maternal hypertension, preeclampsia. These things, so for example, these are histology slides from a normal placenta and preeclamptic placenta, and you just see that here there is less stuff. I mean, their vasculature penetrates less. Okay, so its development is suppressed. And we found very strong and significant correlations of beta with these diseases, which are known to affect the vascular development. So, this is, yeah, so here are some correlations that we found. Maybe I should, okay, so anyhow, so this basically, so far, has confirmed our worldview and seems to confirm that the deviations in the shape of placentas come from the deviation in the vascular growth. And also, as an upshot of all of this, we have obtained a quantitative measure of the vasculature, which we should think of as a fractal dimension. It's a biologically relevant version of the fractal dimension, which is this metabolic scale and exponent beta. And perhaps as a final amusing comment, since my time seems to be up, there is a quantity which is very commonly measured for newborn babies when the weight of the placenta is measured, and usually this is why placenta is the weight of the placenta is recorded. This measurement is called FPR, the fetal placental ratio. And it is what you would think it is. It's the ratio of the two weights. You take the weight of the baby and you divide it by the weight of the placenta. So this implicitly assumes, this is recorded all the time, especially in the studies in developing countries like India, where you have a wide range of malnourished mothers who produce smaller, you know, undernourished babies. And then you get a very wide range for this ratio, and lots of conclusions are made from that. But this ratio implicitly assumes that the baby's weight scales linearly with the placental weight, whereas it doesn't, as we show. It doesn't. So in a normally developed baby, the fetal placental ratio would just be the birth weight to the power 1/4. And you get pretty much, you know, you get pretty much all the spread that you see in these studies just from this. So, you know, this is the graph that they get, and the true graph is 1. That's what you get if you correct to this exponent and you raise, before you take the ratio, you raise the birth weight to the 3/4, and you get pretty much all the range from the fact that you're multiplying by the baby mass to the power 1/4. So light babies would give you a small FPR and heavy babies would give you a big FPR, and it's going to be a fairly large spread. So, okay, some references. We have 3 papers which have appeared or are in press in Placenta, and there is another paper on the way. There are some people have been working on modeling angiogenesis. There are some very well-developed local models. So the first paper is an example. There's a group of people in the UK mostly who are developing various local models of angiogenesis. So these models would describe how a single strand grows. So if you point in the tree where the new growth should occur, that's what the model would describe. As for global models, there are some two-dimensional global models of angiogenesis. So the second reference is an example of those. This is modeling vascular growth in a tumor. And the tumor is a skin tumor, so they assume that it's two-dimensional. Okay, in this case, there is no vascular tree structure, and the mathematical, it's also a stochastic growth model, but the mathematical basis for the model is not DLA, it's percolation. It's based on a 2D percolation. Okay. And finally, once I started talking about this, it turns out that this was, after all, invented by the French. There is a paper by Vincent Fleury from Paris and his student in journal Fractals, in which diffusion-limited aggregation is mentioned as a candidate for modeling angiogenesis. But somehow this was never developed anywhere. Okay, thank you for your attention. I'll stop here.